Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. On our show, we get a previous guest to ask a question of our current guest. So take a listen.
What is the one book that you would recommend to someone in your field that's inspired you and has guided you on your path?
And here's how our upcoming guest answered.
A book called Audition by a man named Michael Shurtleff. It was edifying for me in terms of the larger question of who am I as an actor and how do I present myself?
Now on One with Farai, we have actor, director, and now a academic, Delroy Lindo. So good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So you decided to go back and get a master's degree, you know.
I did.
And it's fascinating. I asked you what it was about, and you told me it was about the Windrush generation.
Now, had you heard of Windrush?
Never had. I had known what it was.
You said you had known.
I had known what the generation was, but I had not known the name for the generation.
Got it. In other words, you were familiar with that generation of Caribbean people.
Right, because I have friends from the UK whose parents were Jamaican immigrants. So I have that context. So why don't you tell us a bit about, you know, what your thesis is about and what the Windrush generation is?
I will. June 22nd, 1948, a former German trooper ship, which had been renamed the Empire Windrush, arrived at Tilbury Docks, Essex, England, which is essentially a suburb of London, June 22nd, 1946. So you've got 482 Jamaican men, and I'm not quite sure why, but there were also 60 Polish women on that boat. However, the arrival of these Jamaican men was the start of an influx of Caribbean people to the UK. What happened in the aftermath of World War II was that the United Kingdom needed man and women power to help rebuild the country in the aftermath of World War II. So things like construction, factory work, and nursing. So my mother was recruited, as were many other Caribbean women, from the Caribbean to come to the UK to study nursing. My mom did not come in 48. My mother came in 1951. But this influx of Jamaican men in 1948 started this wave of Caribbean immigrants, all of whom were UK citizens by virtue of the fact that the United Kingdom had colonized all of these Caribbean islands. A piece of legislation was passed in 1948 granting immediate citizenship to all of these Caribbean people. So many of them answered the call from the motherland to go to England, and my mother was one of those people. That generation, starting in 1948 through the 1950s, it peaked in the 1960s and continued on through the 70s and the 80s. That generation of Caribbean people and their offspring became known as the Windrush generation.
I'm fascinated constantly by the ways in which race and ethnicity in the U.S. and the U.K. are different. And, you know, I've often felt that there are things that the U.K. does much better in terms of race, but maybe that's just me being an American.
I really want to know what they are. I agree with you that racial constructs in the U.S. and the U.K. are very different. Now, I have to say this. You know, I have not lived in the U.K. for over 40 years.
Yes, so you were born there.
But I was born there. And the work that I have done in pursuit of my thesis has uncovered for me a lot of knowledge about the history of the U.K., specifically about the history of people of African descent in the U.K., and certainly a lot of, it's uncovered a lot of things about my own history and my mom's history. But in that process, there are certain things I believe that have crystallized for me in terms of what the differences are. But before I speak on that, I'm curious about what your perceptions are about the differences.
Yeah, I mean, for example, growing up in the 80s, when I was in high school and college, I would look at bands from the UK, whether it was ska bands, et cetera, and I would see, for example, interracial and anti-racist bands that were performing together in a way that they weren't in the US, and also in other forms of pop culture. I saw more of a crossover. That was obviously me when I was young.
Right.
But I've also thought, you know, the American Black experience for so long has been contextualized in terms of slavery and Jim Crow. And in the UK, although there was slavery, there was much more of a presence that came as immigration.
Look, I am not a scholar, and I do not want to be on your program presenting myself as a scholar. However, I'm going to give you my opinion. There is a fundamental difference between how the construct of slavery in the United States, all these African people who were brought here forcibly, that's one construct. The basis of the construct of Black people and their relationship to the United Kingdom is based in the colonizer and the colonized. They're very different.
Yeah.
Right? Now, because you are doing this podcast, I am assuming that most of your audience is at least as smart as you are, because you're brilliant.
Oh, dear.
No, yes, you are, which is part of the reason that I wanted to do this. In England, at an earlier age, there's a lot more in the working class strata of society, a lot more intermingling between young Black people and young white people. The English equivalent of what we would call projects here are called
council flats.
Council
right?
flats, thank you. In the average council flat estate, you will see this, you will find this mixing, this racial mixing. So a lot of these kids grow up together. And so because they form those kinds of bonds, those kinds of relationships, I don't know this for sure, but I would hazard a guess that many of those ska bands that came out of England in the 80s, working class people, working class kids, kids who have kind of been raised up together. And that's where you see this racial intermingling, okay?
Yeah.
So that's one thing. The second, for me, profound difference, striking difference, sociopolitically, between the United States and England, or the UK. The UK has not experienced a civil rights movement. That status quo, when I say the status quo, I'm speaking about the very, very strident class system that exists in the UK. And not only the class system, you have all those peers and lords, all of that. And that's deeply embedded in the class system and the status quo, the social, the sociopolitical status quo in England. That has never been challenged in the similar way that the civil rights movement in this country challenged the sociopolitical status quo. As a result of that, status quo in England not having been challenged in the same way that the civil rights movement challenged it here, okay?
Right.
And because that is absent in British culture, the status quo has been able to, I believe, remain entrenched. And therefore, certain aspects of racial dynamics have very, very steadfastly remained, quote-unquote, the same for Black people in England. And they are two vastly different components of the two societies as it relates to race.
Yeah. So what specifically is your thesis on? Just give us a tiny taste.
It is a research project that was born as a result of research that I was doing for a screenplay that I was writing about my mother's life. I am of Jamaican extraction. As I said at the beginning of this, my mom, she arrived in England in 1951. And in pursuit of this screenplay I was writing, I was unearthing and researching the history of the UK and the history of people of African descent in the UK. And because I had unearthed so much material, I momentarily put the screenplay aside and I basically focused on the research. And so my thesis is a research-based project investigating why, as significant as the Windrush era, the Windrush generation are in UK culture, why there are no feature films reflective of that phenomenon. Television, there are a couple of television films, and there have been documentaries, fairly extensive documentaries, but no feature films.
Well, you might be able to rectify that.
I'm hoping to rectify that with my project.
I have really enjoyed getting to know you, you know, outside of your acting work. I mean, I love your acting work, and we're going to turn to that in a second. But you're someone who has a boundless curiosity about the world at large. Mm. And you and your wife are both people who are deeply involved in the arts, not just as, you know, people kind of passing through on a casual level, but people who have a deep, very spiritual commitment, I think, to the arts as transformative. So how do you balance these different roles in your life, like working on this thesis, working on a screenplay, shooting, you know, the movie Cymbeline, you know, all of these things that you do?
Yeah. I guess it comes down, Farai, to a matter of survival. And what I mean by that, and I really don't want to sound pretentious here, but the commitment to the work is social and political, and one can't separate those things. And interestingly, for me, I can't separate those things even when I am working in the commercial construct of Hollywood. So how does that manifest for me? I'd like to think that it manifests from the standpoint of the kinds of work that I take and the kinds of work that I don't take. Clearly, this is not to say that the work that I do as an actor, they're all politically correct or politically, you know, I've done a range of things. I played criminals. I played a man who had an incestuous relationship with his daughter in the Cider House Rules. So I'm not speaking about individuals who are morally, quote unquote, correct necessarily. But what I am speaking about, I'd like to think that the manner in which I approach the work comes out of a certain kind of a social and political acculturation that I have, which means that I'm looking for, in whatever I do, I'm asking myself the question, who is this human being? Is there a way for me to illuminate some aspect of the human condition with this work? And that's the component that I'd like to feel that I take into everything that I do. And I think, very, very broadly speaking, that's socio-political in acculturation.
Yeah, and I think that's what I meant by spiritual. I didn't mean in a religious sense at all, but just sort of that mission-driven impulse.
Mission, that's a great term.
That flows through your work. So how do you decide if a character is one that you want to take on? How do you, I mean, on a more granular level, how do you evaluate a script or a storyline and say, I can make this into something where I am illuminating the human experience?
I will not say that can I illuminate the human condition here is a primary question. What is a primary question for me is, can I make this a three-dimensional human being? And so what I'm looking for in a script, in a screenplay, whatever the case may be, is there enough there that I can flesh out, that I can tease out to present a human being that I find interesting and that therefore the audiences will find interesting? And that's the guiding principle. Did I answer your question?
Absolutely.
Okay.
110%.
Okay.
So the movie Cymbeline is a version of Shakespeare. And
yeah, it's Shakespeare on film.
Yeah, Shakespeare, yeah. Which is very in vogue.
Yes,
you know, really interesting run of different Shakespeare plays over just the past 5 years, certainly the past 15, which work to recontextualize the bard in a modern setting. And I understand this version of Cymbeline is contemporary, and Ethan Hawke is also in it. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's actually a wonderful cast. Ethan Hawke, Bill Pullman, John Leguizamo. Tremendous cast.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about the scenario in which this is staged.
Well, it is a contemporary interpretation, meaning that we're all wearing clothing that contemporary audiences will recognize. You know, I have a scene in a gas station pumping gas, and we go into the 7-Eleven and purchase some things. But the language is all Shakespeare, even though, because it is a feature film, a lot of the language was chopped up and is presented in a different way than it would be in the theater. I don't want to forget that, you know, Ed Harris plays Cymbeline. So it's a tremendous cast. I'm really curious to see what the end result is.
That must be fun sometimes, or terrifying, to be like, okay, I did this, but I don't know what it's going to be.
I wouldn't say terrifying. I've learned many, many, many years ago to adopt somewhat of a circumspect point of view about the work that I do and divorce from that process my own personal feelings from whatever the finished product is. Because what I've learned is that, for instance, I can have, you know, not so good a time filming a certain piece of work. The film is released to audiences and audiences love it. And the fact that audiences respond, in a sense, feeds into my appreciation for the film or for the work, because I'm enjoying, I'm appreciating the fact that they're appreciating the work. And whatever problems I may have had making the work kind of sort of becomes secondary. Now, I don't want to say that I will have a terrible time on a film and the film is released and audiences love it and that makes all of my bad feelings disappear. No. But what I've learned is that there's an additional component in work which exists when a piece of work is released to the audience. I take all of that into account.
Yeah. Do you have a preference for theater or film, or how do you feel about that aspect of acting?
I love the theater. I adore the theater. The short answer to your question is they both have extraordinary merits, and the merits are very, very different. I come from the theater. I'm a theater-trained actor, and nothing replaces the communion that exists when you're doing a really good work, piece of work, and that communion that exists between the work that the actors on stage and the audience, and that engagement, and nothing replaces that. It's an extraordinary thing. I also really love the communal aspect of rehearsal process in the theater. I mean, I've grown up on that creatively, and I yearn for that. One doesn't get that in film. But what film does have that is magical is the camera and the relationship with the camera that one can establish through one's work. And when you're doing a really wonderful piece of work and that work is released to the audiences and audiences respond, that all of those processes are magical. They're magical. And I love the breadth and the depth, the global breadth and depth of film. Many years ago, my wife and I were in we were in Rome. And have you been in Rome?
Yes, I have.
Okay. I mean, I figured you had.
Well, you never know.
No, well, yeah, I figured you'd been in Rome. But we were at the top of the Spanish Steps.
I was about to mention the Spanish Steps.
The Spanish Steps.
Which have been in so many movies.
They've been in so many movies. And this particular day, I was at the Spanish Steps because my wife was dragging me. And we were about to go down the Spanish Steps. And these two Italian cats passed us. He turned. His eyes got really big. And he said, Del Rolindo.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was totally awesome, right? He didn't speak any English, but he said my name, right? Now, and I'm thinking, what has he seen that I have done that apparently has made a significant enough impression on him that he had the name, face recognition, and he knew my name.
Yeah.
That was magical.
Yeah.
And that is the power of film. And that's what I adore about film.
Yeah.
I mean, among other things.
Well, coming in here to the CUNY studios, we certainly had a bunch of people trying to wave you down and
say hi, right.
You know. Does that ever get old, though, in a way? I mean, like, do you ever miss being Delroy Lindo without people knowing you're Delroy Lindo?
Like the anonymity?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I have a lot of anonymity, honestly. I mean, that was interesting. I mean, many people recognize my face. Oh, you that dude. You do the actor dude, right? Oh, yeah. What I know you from? It's that. But it's not like I can't walk down the street. You know, I don't get mobbed, right? I still possess a certain kind of anonymity. To answer your question, no, I don't get tired of it. What I always say, Farai, is that it's that kind of thing, that kind of recognition never gets old, and it's not a problem for me. It will be a problem for me when it stops.
Well, you're just going to have to keep acting forever then.
That's all right with me.
Is there anything else you want to tell us about that you're working on that you're excited about?
Well, I'm really excited about the prospect of writing this screenplay. My intention is to create if not a paradigm shift, but certainly to change the paradigm from the standpoint of creating a feature film that is set in the Windrush era. And in so doing, I want to bring recognition to the forgotten people like my mom, whose life meant so much and it's not been reflected in the cinema. And that is an aberration as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I have to say I'm excited about it too. And I think that the African diaspora is in a very interesting place right now where America, for example, has people like you who are Afro-European by birth, but from, you know, the Caribbean, and, you know, there's Afro-Latino, and we're having to expand our minds a little bit here in the U.S. about what blackness is.
That's a good thing, and the fact of the matter is, on many levels, I relate, you know, African-American, but the fact of the matter is, I was born in Europe, and yes, as you rightly say, I'm of Jamaican extraction, so that mix, it's a mix that, personally, I've come to appreciate that somewhat late in life. But I'll tell you an interesting story. I mean, I know we have to wrap up. But when I was in Barcelona, you've been in Barcelona too, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Of course you have.
To see the Gaudi.
Right, we did that. I'm a soccer fan. You know, having been born in England, I grew up as a young person playing soccer.
Right.
I took my son to the Barcelona, the citadel of the Nou Camp, which is where the Barcelona soccer team plays its home games. As we were walking in, one of the security guards, a Trinidadian brother, living in Spain, he was speaking Spanish with a really interesting accent. And then I guess when he heard me speaking, he started speaking in English. You're from Caribbean? I'm from Trinidad. Oh, wow. You know, you're speaking about the diaspora. We didn't speak for very long. I don't recall asking him, well, how did you get here? But here he is.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, we were going through one of these piazzas, and there were this group of three or four young kids. I don't know, they were 4 or 5 years old, kicking a soccer ball around. And one of them was this little black kid. And A, it reminded me of me, this black child in Europe. And he was not interracial. He was a chocolate just like me, actually darker than me. And I just stopped. And it was just wonderful just to take in that scene for a few minutes. But I was curious as heck, how did he get here? What's his story?
Yeah. So many stories left to be told. But as part of this podcast, we have a sort of baton relay where one guest gets to ask the next guest a question. And so here is one for you.
What is the one book that you would recommend to someone in your field that's inspired you and has guided you on your path?
So a book called Audition, by a man named Michael Shurtleff, which I read many, many years ago when my career was young and I was just starting out. And as its title suggests, it was a primer on how to audition, but it was so much more than that. And that's what I appreciated about the book. He went into a lot of detail about what not to do in an audition, but it was also a primer on how you present yourself as a human being on the planet, using the conduit of acting and the audition process to speak about those things. It was edifying for me in terms of the larger question of who am I as an actor and how do I present myself? Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and I want to read it now. And so the very final thing we ask you to do is take the baton and pass a question to someone who you don't know.
Okay, I will do that. But before I do that, did the person who asked me that question know it was me?
No.
Huh. Check that out.
His name is Adam Merced. He is a music director and DJ for the Knicks. And he had no idea who was coming after him.
Okay, that's interesting. My question is, if you could do one thing to change the educational system in this country, what would it be? That's my question.
I love it. Now that's a deep one, and you'll find out the answer to Delroy's question on the next episode. Delroy Lindo, thank you so much for joining us on One with Farai.
Thank you for having me, Farai. I've got to say one thing before I go, and that is, I mentioned to you before we got on the air that when you asked me to come and do this, even though I do have a bunch of other things going on. The reason that I wanted to do this with you and made the effort to do it is because I have seen you, Farah, I think we met, what, 2 years ago, three years ago? And I have seen you both in social settings, and I've seen you in professional setting when we both presented at that symposium a year or so ago.
Yes, in Detroit.
In Detroit.
For the Sphinx Con.
That's correct. That's right. And the thing that profoundly impresses me about you is that you have all the things that you speak about, the spiritual depth, the intellectual breadth that you have, the curiosity that you have, the sensitivity that you bring to what you do, for me, creates a mastery. I don't know what the female equivalent is. It's terrible. But you have a grasp of those things, and I recognize that.
Thank you.
In terms of how you present yourself. And so I wanted, A, to be in that orbit, because I knew that the conversation, I knew that the communication would mean something and that I would learn something in the process. And I wanted to contribute to that with you.
Well, thank you so much, Delroy. I feel the same way about you. And
thank
I think
you.
That you have superpowers that most of your fans around the world don't even know about. But maybe now, after listening to you, they will.
God bless. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Actor Delroy Lindo has played everything from a gangster in Spike Lee's Malcolm X to an animated character in Up. He just completed a master's degree thesis on the Windrush generation, post-World War II Jamaican immigrants to England, who included his mother. You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. Catch our next installment when I speak with author and former U.S. diplomat Alec Ross about globalization and digital diplomacy.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.